Sourcing Matters Podcast. This is your host, Aaron Niederhelman, sharing stories of our food. And welcome back to Sourcing Matters. This is your host, Aaron Niederhelman. Today, I'm welcomed by a co-host and good friend, Ken Kaplan. Hey, Ken, how are you?
Great, Aaron. It's great to be here with you in the studio somewhere here in Cambridge.
Somewhere here in Cambridge, that's right. Well, I know
Alston.
That's right, on the Alston-Cambridge line. So, well, I know you've been a frequent listener to the show, so I really appreciate you coming in and joining as a co-host. And I just want to talk a little bit about your impressive history at MIT. So over the last dozen or so years, you've been a visiting scholar, a senior health system advisor for the Technological Systems Research Center, and now you're an advisor at the Sloan's Initiative for Health System Innovation. Ken, can you tell us a little bit more what you're up to at Sloan?
Absolutely. Actually, the work at Sloan is a continuation of the work I've been doing at MIT for almost now 20 years. But my background actually is in healthcare. I've got a clinical background and also trained as an architect, which, you know, is kind of an odd combination of skills. But I've basically, over the years, done a number of projects, research projects around this system design. That's my architecture. And, you know, bringing people together on initiatives across the field of health. The Sloan Initiative sits inside the Sloan School's Business School, School of Management. We're working with about 35 faculty, and we're, you know, have a systems approach to health system delivery, and, you know, and it includes not just the delivery side, but also what we call the social determinants of health, which are all the issues that aspects that impact people's health that may not be anything due to your medical system. But food is obviously one of those, housing. And more research is telling us that the social determinants are as important, if not more important, than genetics or who your doctor is. So we have an initiative right now. We're working with California, state of California, Massachusetts, and New York State. And we're focused on the Medicaid population and the challenges and innovations that are going on in that space with people who are underserved. But because of the Affordable Care Act, they've received quite a bit of money to change the way they do care. And we're working with them on testing out what things are doing well and what things are doing not well, and helping them measure outcomes in terms of success. One of the initiatives is Food as Medicine, which is becoming a very exciting more recognized field, where food is seen as a prescriptive, if you will, a pharmaceutical. Literally, you spell pharmaceutical with an F. and there actually has been more and more clinical research, what they call randomized control trials, to show that food actually can impact health outcomes in a more rigorous way. In fact, that's one of the efforts we're going to be working on in this project.
Fascinating. Well, thank you, Ken. That was great. And you hit on a key point that I'd like to segue into our conversation today, which is the idea of a broader systems thinking and how we're much more appreciative of these direct correlation between our health and our food. The most obvious connection point I think that people have is, and to your point about food as medicine or food as preventative care, is the impact on their own well-being. Sure. Of course, Ken, you know, we look at this and we say, you've been involved in this type of research back actually since your days of doing childhood obesity research a decade ago. But it turns out there's more to it. And as it turns out, the way we raise our food is impacting a shared health of the planet and additionally a collective public health. Now, food animals have been a bit of a fulcrum for many of the discussions we've had on Sourcing Matters. Addressing misnomers that food animals are the problem, we focus the lens on many of the conversations in the show on better management practice for potential of net positive environmental impact through encouraging a symbiotic relationship of food animals and natural order. Putting animals back out on pasture, not keeping them in confined units, just makes sense. That said, we haven't given enough time or attention to the other unintended consequence, Ken, which is the fact that the very same shortcuts we're using in putting animals in confined environments and the mismanagement of those food animals is having a heavy impact on public health. So currently we process 9.3 billion animals a year in this country. And by some estimates, over 90% of that production of those food animals are raised in confined environments. So living in environments that don't marry how different species live in natural environments. These production practices use shortcuts in an effort to reduce outbreaks of disease in highly condensed food animal environments. And one of the most common practices is the use of antibiotics prophylactically to increase stocking density and feed efficiency. Now, here's a stat that always throws me for a loop, and I think most people, when they hear this, it's the same, that now over 80% of all antibiotics used in this country are coming on farm. So we got a big problem brewing here. So from my understanding, and I've had opportunity of talking to a lot of experts in the field, and our guest today is surely one of those, biology has a tendency to respond to an attack with resilience. In fact, that the founding father of antibiotics, Sir Alexander Fleming, warned of the slow and perpetual use of penicillin, and now 75 years later, and an ongoing overuse of antibiotics in food has spawned the unintended consequences of antimicrobial resistance, or AMR is the short name for it. The common name, I think, that most people within the healthcare space can, that they know it, is superbugs, right? Superbugs, which now affect there's 2 million cases of superbugs a year, and that is costing the healthcare system over $20 billion and 23,000 lives annually. A 2016 report commissioned by the UK Prime Minister David Cameron reported that AMR could get so bad if we stay with business as usual that by 2050, the economic impact would be $100 trillion and cause more deaths than cancer. Most of the developed world has recognized that these self-induced issues are a major problem. But in the US, we fought that correlation to how we raise our food animals and the impact and the unintended consequence. One of the reasons that mindset is changing and has changed is thanks to our guest today. Our guest today, we welcome Bob Martin, who's the Director of Food System Policy Program at CLF, which is the Center of Livable Future, to the show. Hey, Bob, how you doing?
Good, Aaron. It's great to be with you. Hi, Ken.
Hi, Bob. Great to have you on the show.
And what our audience doesn't know is Ken and Bob go back many years. How long?
Oh,
you guys
come on, Aaron. It's not that long ago.
Well, it's about a decade now. We Ken reached out to me about some of the health system's work, and we found a common interest in the link between the way we raise our food and how and what we eat and its impact on health. And we've been working together off and on ever since, including a conference in 2011 called The Future of Food, and His Royal Highness Prince Charles was the keynote speaker, and Ken suggested that his speech was so good it ought to be a book, and guess what? Rodale Press made it into a book, and for about a month, at least in the D.C. area, it was on the bestseller list, so... Ken and I are friends of long standing, and Aaron, I've known you a while as well, so it's great to be on the program.
Well, I can't thank you enough for many reasons, not just for joining the program, but I'll get into this a bit later on in the conversation. I owe you a great debt of gratitude. You were a huge influence in my life, so I will share. I'll leave that as a teaser for our audience to continue to listen. But Bob, I want to actually talk a bit about definitely what you're doing at Johns Hopkins and the CLF program. But I want to take us back to 2011 or previous to joining the CLF program, when you were the executive director of the Pew Commission for Industrial Farm Animal Production. I read that you managed a comprehensive two-year, $3.6 million study that led to the publication of 8 technical reports and a final 122-page report on the public health, environmental, and animal welfare and rural community impacts of our conventional method of producing meat, dairy, and eggs. The report, which was called Putting Meat on the Table, Industrial Farm Animal Production in America, defined a seminal moment of awareness for U.S. production, food, and health. It's a realization that our approach in raising food animals has broad-reaching human and public health impact. And it's really what I was speaking to in my prelude in this conversation. So, Bob, if you would, maybe you could share with our audience, in the handful of years since you published that report, since your research, and since you delivered this information, have we seen transformative change? Are we getting better? What is the current state of affairs with the pending pandemic?
Well, it's a very good question, Aaron. I hate to say that I don't think we've made a lot of progress, either legislatively or in the regulatory sector at the federal level. There were some very incremental things done in the Obama years that at least we know with a little more precision the amount of antibiotics being used in food animal production, but it really hasn't, by volume, slowed down that much. I think one of the main things that's happened is that consumers, in part because of the Pew Commission report that sparked a lot of non-governmental organizations to get very active in this area to eliminate the non-therapeutic use of antibiotics in food animals, really started making demands at the marketplace. And I think it led directly to Purdue, the major chicken company in the eastern United States, to totally eliminate the non-therapeutic use of antibiotics. Well, actually, they eliminated all antibiotics from their broiler chicken production system. That's the chickens we raise for meat. Tyson, looking at Purdue kind of cornering an emerging, growing, aggressive market, committed to do the same. And now they have eliminated antibiotics from their broiler chicken production. But on the five-year anniversary of the Pew Commission report, which is now 5 years old itself, we did an analysis of all the recommendations to see what type of progress had been made. At that time, I think we gave the government an F for trying to address any of the recommendations. And it was not only the non-therapeutic use of antibiotics, but increasing oversight, regulatory oversight of how waste from these operations is distributed or disposed of. Only about, at the time the Pew report came out, only about 60% of the operations were permitted through the Clean Water Act, which is the regulatory legislation. And so there was an enormous amount of waste being applied to surrounding farmland and sometimes very close to homes. We don't really know. I mean, the tests that have been done on the waste show there's lots of antibiotic-resistant bacteria, lots of antibiotics themselves, some metals, and generally harmful pathogens. So I think that a lot of the impetus for change has come through the marketplace, come through consumers demanding an improvement in how antibiotics are used. And I think another part of, you see, like Purdue bought Niman Ranch, which is like the, you know, the Cadillac way of raising animals. And so there is this market-driven change. It's just not as been as well handled through the regulatory sector. Worldwide, it's a real problem. China is expanding their swine operations aggressively to meet demand of a growing middle class. I think the European Union has probably done the best in restricting antibiotic use in food animals. But it's a worldwide problem, and we've really not made great progress here in the United States.
One thing that I have recognized that maybe it might be anecdotal or it might be confirmation bias because the folks we definitely bring on the show, but in the last few years, it seemed that we're moving past the NAE, the no antibiotic ever model, which was the first response to these concerns, and realizing that you know, we do need antibiotics. When animals are sick, just like when humans are sick, we need them to deal in short, heavy bursts with whatever those issues may be. But the slow, perpetual practice needed a new operating system. And to your point around Niman, that delivered that it came back to more of a regenerative-based approach for raising food animals. And it seems there's been more of an awareness to that. And maybe it is all consumer-driven at this point. Bob, how would you recommend more folks engage inside of that? Is it to ask your producers? Is it your grocers? Is it ask your local meat providers to do something different with the way their meat? Or is it traceability and transparency? What would you suggest we do to continue to move the industry in the right direction?
Well, there are a number of things. I think parents can get involved with their school districts and ask that their districts adopt something called the Good Food Purchasing Program, which not only addresses the non-therapeutic use of antibiotics, but also it addresses animal welfare concerns, concerns about the environment, concerns about the workers in not only in concentrated animal feeding operations, but you know, in vegetable production. That type of kind of procurement-based approach can be very effective. And so fairly large school districts in California have adopted them. Los Angeles, Oakland, and I guess San Francisco is considering it. It hasn't adopted it yet. Chicago Public School System's adopted it. So that type of approach, I think, would be very impactful, because it's really, mothers and fathers get very motivated when they're concerned about their kids. And then I think it's also you vote with your food dollars and being selective about the companies you buy from and making sure the local markets know, the local supermarket knows. So I think those are things that can be done as well. There has been some interest on the investing side that you it's a little bit like the divestment of during the apartheid fight years ago, or divesting from nuclear power plants, that there's a growing interest in pushing investment companies to promote more sustainable production. So there's a number of those types of things that can be done. And also, I spent a lifetime in politics before I start doing what I'm doing now, and I think it's always good to tell your policymakers what you're interested in.
Bob, one thing that's always fascinated about your CLF is that it sits inside a school of public health, which is not typically a place you would find a expertise on the ag system. How is that standing up, and, you know, what have been the pros of that and the challenges of that?
Well, it is unique. So about 22 years ago, Dr. Bob Lawrence, our founding executive director, he was the associate dean of the School of Public Health, went to the dean, who was a close friend of his, Dean Al Somer, and said that he would like to start exploring these issues, the direct public health impact of the way we raise our food. We also have on the consumption side as well the types of food you choose, and that choice's impact on the climate. So it was Bob Lawrence and Dr. Polly Walker as brainchild, and we kind of got a foothold, and we found pretty quickly that I wasn't involved, so this is what I'm told, that the linchpin is the way we raise food animals, and It's important on, you know, the soil, how the health of the soil, and it's important for human health. And one of the people that we feel very positive about is Sir Albert Howard, who you guys I know are familiar with. But in 1936, he said the issue of soil, plant, animal, and human health is all one topic, and it was unique. 22 years ago, it's still a bit unique. I think being in the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health is a real benefit because of the reputation we have. We're the number one public health school in the country. I think we've been very helpful internally among the other departments in the School of Public Health, really kind of leading the way about food animal production, its impact on the environment, its impact on the climate, and its impact on human health. What could be a downside, I guess, is academic institutions aren't known for moving quickly. So coming from the political world, sometimes I chafe a bit, but it's to be.
I think what academia can do is convene unique stakeholders together. And I would actually say that both you and Ken, in my mind, are some of the best at actually bringing thought leaders together, having engaging conversations, and then defining specific mission-critical aspects to come out of that, so defining actually deliverables and moving that. So I'm going to turn this question to both you and Ken and ask, can you share a bit with our audience? You had mentioned the program that you did at Georgetown with Prince Charles, but you've done many of these. And Ken, you too have done many of these, convening these forums. What have you learned from these types of think tank gatherings, and have you been able to solidify more results than just more talk with the Johns Hopkins CLF program? So, Bob, maybe you can start, and then Ken, I'd love you to join in on that conversation.
Yeah, we found that Hopkins does have a very strong convening powers, as I think Harvard and MIT do, and Columbia, a number of institutions do. And I do believe that we've been able to periodically pull together opinion leaders and researchers and academics from diverse backgrounds. And it's really, we kind of educate one another as well as generating new information for the people attending the conferences, but also, that's published in academic journals. So I do think there is a strong component, behind our ability to convene experts. I'm participating in one that a convening this November in a couple of months called Choose Food, that is being done by the School of Public Health, not with some involvement of the Center for a Livable Future, but mainly through the Berman Institute on Ethics. And it's being led by actually a former Pew commissioner, Dr. Alan Goldberg. And it's really to bring people together to look at the ethical choices involved in your food choices. I think it's going to be a very interesting gathering. And a lot of times what will happen at a Hopkins convening is a policy volume will come out of that through GHU Press. So that's a way that we can kind of broaden our reach.
And Ken, you've had more of the Northeast realm here in Harvard and MIT. What have you learned, and where does that differ from maybe the policy side? But you've got incredible access to people. How have you utilized that and brought these folks together?
Well, it's not easy, but I think my experience, one of the things that really people seem to be more fascinated with than when I started is this concept of system thinking. I think that people, a lot of these problems are so interlinked that, when you talk about soil health and human health and, those are abstract words, but down inside the science and the the core elements of these, of the human body and the ground, there's huge connection. And our systems are crude. Our research tools are actually kind of crude in trying to decipher not just impact, but causality between a food animal that's unhealthy, and then how does that impact into a person's daily life. On the other hand, when I met Bob, and I really didn't, you know, when I first started, we worked on the Child Obesity Project, I knew nothing about the food system. Bob and a few of his colleagues were instrumental in helping me see the link between particularly animal agriculture, which if you talk to people in healthcare, they have no idea what that is. They're just at the this ability to go to another realm like that is very difficult. So when you bring people like that together and you have a person like Bob in the room with a surgeon at Harvard Medical School, and you know, they start sharing these real factual realities, people get inspired. You know, I mean, particularly if you have people who are smart and trying to think of ways to do things differently. So the systems thinking is essential, and actually bringing people together is a way to get at that system, understanding the full capacity of the system in its most holistic sense.
And Bob, you had mentioned the upcoming event that you have, or conference you have. I think it was called Choose Food. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Yeah. So you said that it was underpinned by maybe an ethical choice of choosing food, which is a whole nother layer into dealing with food animals. One thing that I have seen, which has been interesting, is that a bit of a, from many of the animal activist side, there's been a bit of a realization that people are going to eat animals. And as long as we have a responsible management practice and invest in the animals' living conditions and environment and well-being, there seems to be a bit of common ground, maybe a little more gray area that we're finding this. Is that part of the objective within these conversations at your forthcoming November conference, is to continue to explore that commonality?
Yes, it is. It's I've participated in a couple of the planning sessions, and it's a really interesting, diverse group of people from the corporate sector, from people with religious training, people with public health training, and then the Berman Institute of Bioethics is at Hopkins, and that is a group that looks at ethical, ethical questions kind of throughout public health and medicine. And so, yeah, that's exactly the goal. And I think it's going to be a very interesting layer of all this, over all this. You know, one of the things about the Pew Commission, we looked at animal welfare concerns, and there is a strong overlap between strong positive animal husbandry and ethical treatment of animals. And so it's a very interesting part of the conversation that is not, I strongly believe this won't be a preachy type of conference. It'll just be bringing some of these this viewpoint to into a broader realm, I should say.
I would guess in 2018 we also have ethical questions about, do we genetically engineer animals? Do we clone animals and food animals, which I'm sure are all furthering the conversation about our responsibility at the top of the food chain.
Right. Well, and one of the interesting things, too, is I know some people, and I don't criticize anybody for their food choices, because there's enough of that that goes on in the United States. But to have a regenerative plant agriculture system, animals are an integral part of it. It's just a way that the bifurcation of the animals, separating them out into the conditions now that require subtherapeutic use of antibiotics to maintain the health of the animals as they get through the system, and then applying the waste, it comes in such a volume that the ground can't handle it, so it's detrimental to the soil health. But for a really regenerative agricultural system, it's important to have the animals integrated into a cropping system. So, they're a necessary part of a healthy system.
Ken, might have been one of the most clear 1 minute of Sourcing Matters podcast that we've had thus far. I'm going to take that snippet out and cast it across our network. That was beautiful, Bob. I couldn't agree more. And that is, I think, a conclusion that more individuals have to come to and make those own, you know, and the fact that, as you mentioned earlier, they can vote with their grocery budget and they can vote of how they want to use these natural resources and regenerative best practice is an exciting evolution. Ken, I wanted to mention, and I think I teased this in the beginning, that Bob was my inspiration for a fellowship program where I studied production models to alleviate the overuse of antibiotics in food animals. I had an opportunity to go to Europe, and I learned the Dutch approach, which they defined as a golden triangle, which used both a carrot and stick approach to enact federal mandates, the top of the triangle, and then free markets and academia. So, Bob, I wanted to ask you, coming back full circle here, what can we expect to see in the States if it is a consumer-driven approach? Do we have our own version of a golden triangle flipped on its side? Will we ever be reliant on federal mandates, or is it going to be a series of local and regional mandates that then mesh with those free market demand?
Well, that's a very good question, and I'm afraid my crystal ball is a little bit hazy, but I think what would make sense, and I think this is the way it likely will happen, is there will be that increasing oversight or push at the local and state level that will end up, and the marketplace that will end up eventually requiring federal action. I saw a notice that you just had Congresswoman Pingree on a program, and I was at a conference with her a couple of years ago, and we were both on the program, and I talked about, of course, she's a wonderful advocate for organic and sustainable agriculture and integrating animals into the landscape. And I talked to her about, or I didn't talk to her about it, but my presentation was about the market-based, consumer-driven at first. And she came up to me afterwards and said she thinks absolutely that it'll have to be the local, state, regional, and consumer-driven to get to the national to make it safe for people to, for federal-level politicians to act. And it reminded me of the chairman of the Pew Commission, was former governor of Kansas. His name was John Carlin. Always had a saying that I loved, and he said, politicians will see the light when they begin to feel the heat. So I think that outside-in, sometimes it's called an outside-in strategy, I think is what will happen here. The Dutch and the Danes and Germans and the Scandinavian countries, Denmark, Sweden, Norway, and Finland, have been so progressive in tackling these issues head on, and they are decades ahead of us. I'm glad that you were able to go through the Dutch program. As a matter of fact, our new director is a Dutch national, so I think we're going to try to take a bit of what we know in the U.S. At CLF and become more and more active globally.
Yeah, I just wanted to support Bob's notion of the bottoms-up, consumer-driven, market-driven change, and we've clearly seen that in healthcare. It's interesting right now that the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, is now more popular than it was, 3 or 4 years ago, and health is the one of the primary issues that people are still concerned about in terms of the upcoming elections. I think the role of concept of health has become pervasive throughout the, not just populations in the United States, but across the world. I think people are much more aware of what it means, much more take it personally. And I think, things like genomics and genetics are actually becoming less informative as opposed to, things like what you eat and where you live. But I think that we're seeing right now that the healthcare system is going to change. It always has been a local system, but the changes going on are much more local, and eventually will be communicated down to Washington, which really doesn't know much about what's going on the ground.
Hmm. Yeah, great.
Is that an obvious?
No, I think that's wonderful to reiterate that. And to your point earlier, that's a systems thinking approach to this. This is taking a holistic perspective that I think actually provides people a certain level of comfort that we're reevaluating some of these. We've gone to a very reductionist approach and now are reassessing. And to Bob, your point about what, you know, Congresswoman Pingree mentioned in our conversation, which I thought was fantastic, and she cited Michelle Nichon's program on Wholesome Wave as an example of the double bucks at, you know, doubling SNAP program at farmers markets, and then prescription produce program that they launched, that the opportunity here stateside seems to be test it out, prove it, whether it's through NGO, nonprofit, or even for-profit entities, if there's some public good, if there's something that can be empowered therefore after within a federal government program or a state program, that's the opportunity we have, is to show success and then work our federal programs to then leverage that for many of these multidimensional values that we've been talking about, and food obviously being ground zero for many of these discussions.
Yeah. Another point I want to make that's changed, that is actually could help what Bob and I are trying to do, is the role of data, particularly at a place like at MIT. The interest in what we call data analytics is becoming increasingly prominent across the campus, in industry and government. Obviously, there's been a lot of in the press, but I think that the data can be incredibly useful in pinpointing system change and understanding, because you can now collect data across many different kinds of domains, food system, health system, and you can actually start looking at the interfaces of those systems using very strong analytical tools, machine learning, things like that. So, I mean, these are things down the road, but, you know, I think that I still believe in facts and evidence, and I think...
Not alternative facts, no.
Well, you know, I mean, it's a good... one thing I am concerned about is the diminishment of science in our public dialogue right now. That is not a healthy thing. I'm curious, Bob, with your background and long-term experience in D.C., I mean, what's your sense at this point of the effect of Washington on the kind of research you're doing?
Well, it's been a bit of a chilling effect. One of the things, it's really a long-term trend that started a while ago, that public research dollars into agricultural production issues really started declining a few years ago, and it was replaced by, company money, you know, Purdue and Tyson. I mean, there's a Tyson University, they call it, at the University of Arkansas, which is their poultry science division. And, you know, they just recently announced a big new, you know, poultry science center at the University of Georgia that was funded by companies. So when those public dollars, which fund research for the good of all of us, decline or diminish, frankly, because of attacks from people who don't really care about science over the years, then it's replaced by corporate money. And I've never begrudged any corporation from wanting to do research, but they tend to do research that benefits their system or their model, as opposed to unbiased research. So you've had that trend for a while. Now what you have is hostility towards scientific evidence, which, you know, is something frighteningly new. And I'm hopeful, if not yet optimistic, that it's a passing thing.
So, Bob, you have a new director at the Johns Hopkins CLF. You've got some interesting convenings of the minds coming up here. What's next for you and for your initiative? What can we expect to see in coming months and coming years coming out of your center?
Well, we've got a bit of a new focus on, as I mentioned earlier, just briefly, being able to tell people what their climate impact is based on their food choices. We've collected the data from the Foreign Agricultural Organization of the UN FAO for 144 countries, and we've run the data on about 8 different types of diet scenarios, and we can tell in those 144 countries how those dietary choices impact differently, what the differences are between countries. It's pretty clear from some of the initial stuff I've seen that there's a disparity between the developed world and the developing world about meat consumption, that we eat way too much meat, we consume too much dairy and eggs, and in some of the low and middle income countries in the developing world, they actually need dairy and eggs for nutritional reasons. So there's that imbalance, and we'll be able to show that. We've got a series of 3 economic reports that I hope we get out in the next year with an outside economist from the University of Tennessee, that one of the main ones I'm interested in is showing the different costs to taxpayers of how the Farm Bill is structured. So if you support commodities in a certain way and keep the animals separate in a system like we have now, what does that mean for government expense? And whereas if you have more strict production controls and you reintegrate the animals, what's that mean? And I think an initial look, we need to obviously do the in-depth analysis, but the initial look is if a system that's more regenerative is actually returns more income to the producer and is less costly to the government. But I still may be disproven, which I'd be fine with, just so long as you get the answer. And then we have an ongoing program called the Food Voter Project, which is kind of a cute name for we just want to do polling on the public's attitudes and opinions about the food system. We did the first poll in 2015 on the Dietary Guidelines for Americans when those were being debated, focusing on do people want science-based or political-based recommendations? And it was overwhelmingly, science-based. Keep the nutritionists and scientists and academics in charge of this process. Don't let the politicians take it over. Also very strongly for lower meat consumption and a consideration for how that meat is raised, sometimes tagged as the sustainability of the system. Then we did a deep dive on Maryland poultry producers or Marylanders' attitudes about poultry production because it's such a dominant industry in Maryland. And the most recent one, which we did just a couple of months ago, was on the Farm Bill, which is a very it's a difficult piece of legislation to pull on because not many people know much about it, and it's like, everything in the kitchen sink.
Yeah. And if our listeners want to view this information, I will put a link at the bottom of the write-up of the show. I did take a look at the website, and it's a long URL, but I think the best way to do is to type in Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health in the CLF to get access to that. And will all those reports be available on your website when they come due?
Yes. Yes, they'll be available. If you look at our website, Ken will understand this, but it's a mess because we put everything that we've ever done on the website, and academics do in-depth studies and reports. So it's a bit of a mess to navigate, and we're going through a process now to make it a little more user-friendly.
Yeah. Well, the good part about it is that it's all tremendous information and should be commended for the great work, Bob. I appreciate everything that you're doing. Ken, do you have final thoughts?
Wow, hungry. I'm hungry for a hamburger.
For a hamburger, a grass-fed, regeneratively raised animal.
Well, it's always great to hear Bob. Bob's insights, his experience, both in politics and communications. But the years I've known him, he's been getting deeper involved in actually academia and helping the academic world communicate the density of some of their work. I have the same experience. I mean, I did research for many years. And I think Bob has been, I just want to highlight the Future of Food conference that Bob was very much behind the scenes, as far as I could see, my opinion, was responsible for, where you had Prince Charles come to this country, gave a tremendous speech, and the room was, talk about a convening, it was a blowout event. And I think it had an enormous impact at that time on the community and everyone who was there, and I think Bob was clearly put that together. And I'm always interested in what Bob's up to. He's a troublemaker in a good sense, and I enjoy this conversation immensely.
Yeah, Bob, I can't thank you enough for partaking in today's conversation. It was a true honor for me, as I mentioned, you've been a huge influence on my professional career and on me. So what an opportunity. I'll just say until next time.
Well, thank you again, Aaron, for having me. And it's, you guys have both been a strong influence on me. I probably should admit this, but I wasn't really clear that what I've done is systems thinking until I talked to Ken. And Aaron, I've always enjoyed our associations over the years. I think we first met at Harvard at a conference, 5 or 6 years ago. So that's also, telling of the power of convening.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Bob, and we'll speak soon.
Good to talk to you both.
Bye.
Thanks, Bob.